Welcome to the Freedom Report, broadcasting from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to the Freedom Report. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Who's Austin Peterson?
Liberty champion Austin Peterson, this Justin Bieber lookalike, and a powerful advocate for liberty.
Who's Austin Peterson? I'm an American. I love life, liberty, and family, but I'm not a conservative. I'm a hardcore libertarian. What am I doing here? I'm trying to restore the republic. The Libertarian Republic is a website aimed at furthering the ideas of economic freedom and personal liberty. I don't really care about parties. All I care about are ideas. And the one idea I care the most about? Freedom! That's right, pure freedom on the Freedom Report podcast.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Freedom Report podcast. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. My special guest today is Joseph Heumeier. He's an Iraq War veteran and an expert on asymmetric warfare. He's currently the executive director of the Center for a Secure Free Society, a think tank which focuses on advancing security and freedom around the world. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Austin. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm happy to, you know, offer my insights.
Excellent. So we're going to be talking today about the big news, but I just want to let people know the reason that Joe and I sort of reconnected was because Joe had heard an older episode of the Freedom Report podcast, one that I actually got in a lot of trouble for. It was a show where I criticized Ron Paul for his rhetoric. Not his position, but his rhetoric, which to me seemed like a defense of Vladimir Putin and Russia. And so Joe heard that and was like, hey, you know, Austin's got some criticisms of libertarians' rhetoric. Again, not our positions, but the rhetoric. And we're going to talk later in the show about that podcast. We're going to talk a little bit about, you know, the type of rhetoric that libertarians might be able to use to advance our non-interventionist foreign policy in a way that might actually sell to the American people and not sound like, well, you know, a peace in our time, you know, the what do they call it? Who was the guy that came back from Adolf Hitler was waving the piece of paper and was like, you know, conservatives always rip libertarians saying, you guys are just like that British guy who came back from Hitler. He was trying to make peace in our time and he didn't know that Hitler was, well.
Or the first piece of propaganda.
You know, the first, yeah, propaganda, right? That, yeah, the, for, that's what they always say, non interventionists. You know what I mean? You'd let the Nazis run all over the place. As a matter of fact, I just got done with an interview on Sun News Network and I was criticizing Romney and Obama for supporting intervention in Iraq, and they're like, but your foreign policy has failed, Austin. They said, you know, the Monroe Doctrine, non-intervention is a big failure. Like, do you think that non-intervention is a failure, Joe?
No, I mean, not. I think there's. You make some really good points, and I heard the Sun News interview, and I think you made some really good points as far as Iraq. Iraq was a bad intervention on any scale that you look at it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the purposes, the intentions that we went into Iraq aren't the outcomes that we see today. But I think we have to delineate and define what interventions are. It's a bit of a broad term, and it encompasses a lot in there. I think so. Let's talk a little bit about war, because mm-hmm. that's essentially what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Warfare, in a conventional sense, can be defined in five domains, potentially six. Mm-hmm. The first three domains of warfare, you're talking about air, sea, and land. That's generally, I think, what libertarians and most people, when they talk about intervention, they're talking about intervention in one of those domains of warfare. You know, fighter planes bombing targets like they're doing in Syria, troops on the ground like they are in Iraq, or maybe maritime ships patrolling the waters and getting close to sovereign territory. Those type of interventions are outdated. They're what they call the first, second, and third generations of war mm-hmm. that happened during World War II and Vietnam and before. The last three domains of warfare is what we're talking about when we look at things like cyber, space, economic, financial. And these domains of warfare is where contemporary wars are fought today. Mm-hmm. They're mainly encompassed around the intelligence, what they call intelligence preparation in the battle space. So when you engage in those type of warfare, it's a form of intervention, mm-hmm. but it's actually meant to prevent full-scale invasions or to prevent kinetic conventional conflict. Right. And so when we say we don't want interventions, are we talking about that we don't want conventional kinetic interventions, or are we also including non-kinetic, unconventional interventions? Right. And my argument would say some of the non-kinetic unconventional interventions actually can help us preclude and evade war.
Well, a lot of my listeners, they may have not quite understood quite a lot of the terminology that you use. I think I've got some military men and women who probably listen to the show. But for the most people, I think that for the layman's, we we need to break down exactly what we've just said. And what that means is what Joe's saying is like there are certain things that you can do to avoid actual kinetic warfare, meaning a hot war, a war that we're actually, you know, soldiers are fighting or we're bombing. And those kinds of things may be considered interventions, perhaps, you know, sending a spy into a country or something like that you might think of. And those are the kinds of things that might be necessary for a libertarian foreign policy in order for us not to be as interventionist, not to have as many kinetic actions. And so Joe Heumeier and myself, we're always looking for opportunities to try and avoid war because we want to have a less interventionist, a less militaristic foreign policy, a less aggressive foreign policy. But that does require some intelligence gathering. And so what we're looking for is the ideal solution and the perfect rhetoric that we can offer to the American people during an election for, let's say, Rand Paul or Ted Cruz or Rick Perry, for example. We can say to them, hey, if you're going to run on a libertarian platform and you want to dial down the militarism, which I think most people in the United States are war weary, they're sick of these conflicts in the Middle East and they want to be out of it, well, then we're going to have to craft our libertarian rhetoric in such a way that it's palatable to the American people. Now, before we really talk about the libertarian rhetoric, which we're going to get into later in the show, we're going to have a big discussion about this. We're going to talk about Ron Paul. We're going to talk about Rand Paul. We're going to talk about foreign policy. Let's talk about the news of the day. You know, let's get to what the big news of the day is so that we can cover that, and then we can get into the philosophy. The Washington Post reported yesterday that the president is stretching legal and policy constraints that he created. So he created these legal and policy restraints for bombing Syria, right? But a lot of people are saying that there's a very shaky legal ground for his authority to be acting unilaterally to attack ISIS in that country. What do you think?
Well, I think Syria is a conundrum of different type of legal implications, legal problems, and not just legal problems, but actually military problems. We don't control the airspace in Syria as we did in Iraq. So bombing campaigns in Iraq are very much simpler. We have eyes on target. We can get things accomplished in a much quicker manner. In Syria, we have to go through different protocols. The idea that Assad did not know that we were bombing Syria is a myth. There's absolutely that he didn't know. He wouldn't have let us enter the airspace. Assad has some of the most sophisticated air defense capabilities in the Middle East provided by the Russians.
Right.
So he absolutely did know that we were going into Syria before.
Because didn't we threaten him a little bit, saying, hey, if you bring your surface-to-air missiles to bear, you're going to have a problem?
Well, we had if we rewind last year, we were talking about bombing Assad.
Yeah.
Unleashing chemical weapons on his own people. And the main determinant factor in that and that decision, policy decision, was that his surface-to-air technology was far superior, so we didn't want to just make that commitment without having any type of backing.
Right.
So in this sense, I think, you know, there's a lot of problems into going into Syria. We talked about the airspace. I think the intelligence, what you were mentioning before, is a huge hole.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's over 1,000 rebel groups in Syria. How do we actually know who works for who talks to who?
Well, let's just arm them anyway, right?
Well, you know, you arm them and they could just go full circle and get right back to the people that you're fighting against. You know, there's proven cases of the Islamic State taking weapons that we provided to other groups. Either they steal them or they buy them. I mean, there's a good case in the case of the last journalist that got beheaded, not James Foley, but the
Sotloff.
Other. Exactly, Sotloff. My understanding was that when he arrived at the border between Syria and Turkey, the way Islamic State captured him was they didn't really apprehend him or kidnap him right on the spot. He was actually captured by a rebel group
right.
who then sold him
right.
to the Islamic State. So there's a lot of affiliations and connections and relationships that we don't know because we haven't been in Syria preparing the battle space, as I mentioned before. We don't have the intelligence capability, human intelligence more than anything, on the ground to really tell us what's what.
Interesting. So here's the big question. I think that this is the one that the American people probably care the most about. Do you believe that ISIS terrorists could potentially pose a threat to the homeland of the United States?
Well, of course. I mean, ISIS, any terrorist group can. We learned this with the Boston bombing. You can have a lone wolf terrorist that can present a threat to the homeland. You know, they just bomb, strap on a bomb and blow themselves up in front of a marathon. And if it causes one, two casualties, that's too many. I think, yes, they do. But we have to put this in context. What kind of threat for what time and what scale? ISIS, I think, presents a bigger threat than some, you know, or more lower scale Islamic terrorist groups, but they don't present a bigger threat than state sponsored terrorism, which is still the biggest threat we have today. And in the counterterrorism community, the A-list of terrorism has always been Hezbollah.
Mm.
And why is Hezbollah the most sophisticated terrorist group? Because they have state sponsorship from Iran. And Iran has the complete power and leverage of the state that they can put those resources and capabilities into this terrorist group to give them much more projections into the homeland than any other group.
Now, you have a book coming out next month that's called Iran's Influence in Latin America.
Correct.
But before I ask specifically about that book, I want to know if you think the United States should be engaging with Persia in the struggle against ISIS.
I think we should be working with the civil society. We missed a huge opportunity in 2009 in the Green Revolution when their own people were saying, listen, we don't want these Ayatollahs. We don't want the mullahs. We want to actually have freedom. And there's still sentiments of that movement in Iran. The problem is that when we didn't support them, we sent a strong message. And I'm not just saying we in the sense of the United States government. When we didn't have a narrative, the United States as a whole, including our civil society, including our the individual, the people, and everything in the Middle East that could help drive and support these movements. And when we send a message, was you're on your own. And when they're on your own, what happens is your sense of strive for liberty gets overcome by fear. Mm. And that's how the Ayatollahs gain an advantage. They gain more legitimacy, they gain more clout, and now they have a much bigger iron fist over their people.
Yeah, and so when you say they have an influence in Latin America, what are you talking about?
Well, I mean, I think the best way to look at it is we have a comparative advantage over Iran in the sense that we don't see their threat every day along our borders. We don't have Iranian missile bases in Mexico and in Canada staring at us. On the flip side, Iran sees that every day. Yeah. They have Saudi Arabia, they have Iraq, they have Turkey. They see our ships, they see our missiles, they see exactly what's going on in Syria. And so they realized many years ago, I'm talking about more than a decade ago, that they have a comparative disadvantage. And so they're strategically orient themselves to diminish that disadvantage over time. Mm-hmm. And so what they looked at is Latin America was fertile territories, an area that the United States largely considered a foreign policy backwater for the United States. There wasn't a whole lot of presence. Our influence was declining. And there was an endogenous movement within Latin America of former communists, but now became 21st century socialists that were actually taking over the region. And they've used that as a good gateway to be able to put their operatives. Now, they can't send ships and missiles and installed bases, but they have a more asymmetric presence. They send their intel operatives, they send their agents of influence, mm-hmm. Their financiers, and all this stuff to build a robust presence so that when the time does come, mm-hmm. that they can reach out.
Yeah, most people in the United States, when they think about Latin America, they're thinking about Venezuelan socialism. Yeah. They're thinking about Argentina. They're thinking about the problems that are related to just Venezuelan socialism, things like that. They're talking about the oil-rich country, but they don't think about potential threats from Latin America. When you say, when you talk about Iran's influence in Latin America, that's like a double foreign don't care for most Americans. Most Americans don't care about what happens overseas. And when we think about Latin America, we're certainly not thinking about Iran, and we're certainly not thinking about anything other than backwater socialist countries who can barely keep toilet paper on the store shelves. So you seem to be sort of alluding to the fact that there may be a potential terrorist threat looming from Latin America. Why is this something that Americans need to keep an eye on?
Well, because in a sense, we have to understand that the world today is more connected than it's ever been. We're not living in an isolated world in the sense that, what happens on one end of the globe is completely unrelated to what happens on the other end. We're talking about Iran, but in a sense, you could extend that to Russia, you could extend it to China. There's an old saying in boxing, which, I used to box back in the day, that says it's the punch that you don't see that knocks you out. And I think as we're, more increasingly focused in the Middle East with the administration's pivot to Asia, we're forgetting about Latin America. But our adversaries aren't. So Iran is saying, okay, as long as they don't look in Latin America, then we can have a more permissive environment. China's making the same calculation. Russia's making the same calculation. And it's the connection of the three that I think changes the balance of power to the point that when we go back to Latin America and we say, hey, look, we want to re-engage in our allies and we want to discuss how do we, boost peace and prosperity in the Western Hemisphere, we're going to run out of people to talk to. They're going to have already their alliances in hold.
All right, so let's move on to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, because I think this is the thing that is most relevant to the listeners here, this audience. They're very interested in discussions on how to avoid war, and I certainly am as well. Joe, just full disclosure, by the way, Joe and I actually used to work together at an international think tank, the Atlas Economic Research Foundation, before it became just Atlas, which is what it is now. And we were always kind of having these conversations back and forth about foreign policy, and we were in a much different foreign policy situation than we were back in 2009, I think, 2009 when we were working together. But now we find ourselves facing a different threat. We're facing ourselves, the libertarians have to deal with debating a foreign policy that involves counterterrorism like we've never seen before. I feel as if, like, when we were debating the problem of insurgents in Iraq, that was one issue, right? And it was easier to suggest that we should just pull out of Iraq because the insurgents at least had some sort of claim to legitimacy. Now the insurgents in Iraq are ISIS terrorists who are beheading innocent journalists, actually killing Americans, and innocent Americans, not just like killing troops or something like that. They're actually engaging in a barbaric form of warfare that does kind of make you think, well, hey, these mother effers, you know, deserve to get a few bombs dropped on their head, you know. And this is coming from somebody who thinks we should pull the hell out of that place. But I do fear a potential 9/11. I want to find ways to avoid it, but I also want to find ways for us to stop wasting so much money. You know, I just read today that we've got the F-35 program. It's going to go over by billions and billions and billions of dollars. How do we square a non-interventionist foreign policy, Joe, with the reality that we need some form of national security? We need somebody to man the missile bases and the nuclear submarines.
Yeah. So let me, if you allow me, Austin, let me try to take this from the abstract and kind of narrow it down to specific.
Okay.
You know, there's a great saying. I'm sure most libertarians have heard this and repeated by Benjamin Franklin, one of our founders, that talked about the trade-off between liberty and security. I think it goes something along the lines of, if you give up your essential liberty for temporary safety or security, you deserve neither or lose both, or
right,
something along those lines. I think it's a good saying in the sense that it establishes that there is a trade-off. I think that's important to understand among policymakers, among libertarians, among the general American public. There is a trade-off between liberty and security. But as anyone knows, with trade-offs, we don't talk in absolute terms. There is no such thing as absolute liberty.
Right.
Just the same as there is no such thing as absolute security. So how do you do
trade-offs? Some anarchists might disagree with you.
Well, sure, yeah, anarchists might disagree. But even in the term of just economic thinking, we lose economic logic, which a lot of anarchism is based off economic logic, is everything's done through margin, on the margin, depending on the conditions at the time. So we have to look at the conditions. That's when you start to look at threat assessments. Threat assessments project.
Right.
They don't look at the past. They don't say, wow, that bomb blew up, that was a big threat. No, that's too late. You have to look into the future.
Right.
And I think the crossroads that we're getting into with understanding how this balance is going to work with the jihadi terrorists is understanding where is the threat coming from and what's the center of gravity for that threat.
Right.
And I think that's where we missed the boat. I think libertarians would sympathize if we actually got to the point where most of the established defense community is actually looking at. Problem is, the policymakers don't see it this way, and
right,
they have political incentives. International terrorism or Islamic terrorism, their center of gravity, meaning their force of power, isn't their training, isn't their beheadings, isn't their number of personnel, it's their ideology.
Mm-hmm.
It's their ability to sway the hearts and minds of the people within their disaffected communities.
Mm-hmm.
In asymmetric warfare, which we were talking a little bit before, the biggest power projections aren't military force, it's public opinion and political legitimacy.
Mm-hmm.
And so any kind of strategy, counterterrorism strategy, has to address those issues. We don't see the president doing that right now. We don't even see him acknowledging that there's a problem.
Yeah, he said these aren't Muslims, he's saying.
Absolutely. So he's actually completely missing the boat when it comes to the core problem. But we also see that among some Republicans. Some Republicans don't want to engage that threat because it's not politically viable.
Right.
Libertarians need to understand that the way we fought communism as a radical, harmful ideology is the same way you fight radical Islam. Radical Islam is a threat, primarily, firstly, to the Muslim communities in their region, but also a threat to the Western civilization, because they don't agree with certain values and principles that are encompassed among individual liberty and natural rights.
G. Gordon Liddy had a famous statement. He says, "You can't kill an idea, but you can kill everyone who holds that idea." Is that what we have to do?
No, not necessarily. You can't kill an idea, but you can replace it.
Right.
Bad ideas are replaced by good ideas. And I think there's a lot. We talked about the Iranian Green Revolution, but there's the whole Arab Spring was a critical moment to say, we introduce a new idea. These are people that are welcome into modern society, welcome into modernity. They see the internet, they see YouTube. They want this taste of, you know, more freedom of expression, which is being repressed in the Middle East. But we had no idea. We did not have the position or the legitimacy or the leverage to actually make a difference. And now we see the Islamists take over. Because in the absence of good ideas, you'll repress back to the more radical ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you don't think that freedom is gonna work, then you'll say, well, let's just have these guys protect us from getting killed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're seeing in the Middle East.
Well, you know, there's the problem of, you know, protecting our own security while trying to project to them a sense of hope. You know, it's sort of like, well, you know, if we're bombing you, but we want you to engage in the principles of freedom and liberty and peace. So the problem is like you said, the policymakers are not on board with our policies, and we're hypocrites by saying, hey, let's offer them classical liberalism or libertarianism. Meanwhile, the Americans are the devil who are bombing them and killing their babies.
And also, you can't have freedom and peace. And say we just in a makeup world, we have the perfect libertarian president, and he promotes individual liberty and he promotes non-aggression in the United States, if you have totalitarians around the world.
Mm-hmm.
That does not work.
Right.
You eventually, what will happen is you will lose your individual liberty in the United States, because all those other actors that are influencing in other parts of the region will encompass upon you. It's vital to U.S. national security and also just to regional and global stability to be able to have more countries that believe in the same values that we believe in, not in the sense of American values, but in values that are encompassed in natural rights, life, liberty, property, and, you know, and if you look at the Declaration of Independence, the pursuit of happiness.
So I always, talk crap on neoconservatives because they, you know, their whole ideology is based on the idea that we need to reshape countries. We need to sort of make the world safe for democracy. That's the idea. As if democracy in and itself is a good, you know. But I think that the fallacy in that way of thinking is you have to compare democracy. Well, not all democracies are created equal, right? So the United States, we're a republic, right? Well, so is Iran. But we have two totally different styles of governance here. And so I think, again, the problem is one of ideology, where the neoconservatives are a bit blind to the idea that a democracy is necessarily going to bring stability, right? Well, look what Saddam Hussein brought to Iraq compared to democracy. Mm-hmm. Saddam Hussein had a dictatorship. It wasn't a benevolent dictatorship. It wasn't some peaceful monarchy or anything like that. It was a pretty brutal dictatorship.
But it kept the balance of power.
And it also, you know, it managed to provide less of a threat of terrorism against the United States. I know Saddam Hussein was involved in intelligence operations against the United States, but again, that's non-kinetic, like you were discussing. So, do you think that that we sort of overvalue our democratic values, our American values, in some ways?
I think democracy is something that isn't a value in itself. Democracy is a system. It's a system. It's an institution. A set of rules. A way of governance. Mm-hmm. And it works in some cases. It doesn't work in others. Democracies don't work at all if they're not endogenous. If they don't come up from the bottom up, society has to kind of grow into a democracy.
Right.
Mature into a democracy. You can't just bring it down from the top down. When we talk about universal values, or even if you want to even put in the context of Western values. I think we're talking more about individual liberty, individual rights, human rights. And those, they're encompassing a democracy, mm-hmm. but not always necessarily. I mean, we were talking about Latin America a second ago. Latin America's figured out that you can use democracies against your own people.
Yeah.
If democracy, all that means is 50+1 in elections,
yeah.
then they'll hold elections every 4 years, but they'll rig the elections, have the same guy winning, Hugo Chavez-like, and then they'll call it a democracy, but they'll repress political freedom, press freedom, economic freedom, and then that's what you see like in cases like Venezuela. So I think when we talk about what are the values that Western society was built on, that can maybe actually add value to other forms of society that they themselves, the people themselves, are actually looking for it because, you know, YouTube is viral now, right? I think that's what we're talking about, individual rights, human rights, and individual liberty. Now, the problem is that those values are being debated in our own country. You know, we have people on different sides of the political aisle and policymakers that don't agree on what are the set of values for our own country. The people that, you know, passing, you know, domestic legislation that they wouldn't advocate another country to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, we went past Obamacare in this country, but we probably would tell another country in another part of the world that's a horrible piece of legislation
yeah.
for your country. You can't afford that.
Yeah.
But we don't lead by example. And I think that's a big deficiency for our foreign policy as well.
I sometimes despair for freedom here in the United States, but then when I compare it and look at it in relative terms around the world, I sort of think, well, you know, America number one. But, I was reading Thomas Jefferson's first inaugural address this morning that he gave in March of 1801. And he was talking about the will of the majority. He was talking about the Democratic majority. But more important than the will of the Democratic majority was the rights of the minority. That when we passed legislation or that when the country decides to move in one way, that we don't trample the individual rights of the minority. And so I think that, you know, in so much ways, we're sort of failing to communicate not only here in the United States, but around the world, when we try and act like we have the moral high ground on things, is we're failing to communicate the importance of the rights of the minority. And to me, that is really the most important thing because, you know, I find myself on the wrong side of most people's opinions most of the time. I'm very independent. You know what? I actually had a Marine
yeah.
call me yesterday, find my phone number because he was pissed at me. You know why?
What's that?
You've seen this.
Marines are pissed in general.
They're pissed. Yeah, I know you're a Marine.
Yeah.
You're a devil dog.
Yeah.
But he was pissed. You know why? Because President Obama gave the latte salute.
Yeah, I saw that.
You saw that? Yeah. And they saw that as disrespectful.
Yeah.
And I got pissed because I think that it's a distraction for us to be focusing on that when we should be focusing on him.
Yeah, I mean, in context, it's not the end of the, you know, it's not going to make or break anything. But, you know, you have Marine Corps based on tradition and Marine Corps respect those traditions. So, any Marine will get upset about that.
Uh-huh.
But I think any Marine will also agree that it's not the most important thing on the policy.
Well, let me get off on this tangent real quick, and we'll get back to individual liberty and that concept. But because he was pissed at me because I was angry that people cared if the president saluted properly. Well, you know, obviously he's being kind of a jerk with the way he's saluting in such a way, but the president has no requirement to salute. And my point with this was, is that the president, the commander-in-chief, the commander-in-chief position is actually a civilian position. And so I think the problem is that when people are like, well, he needs to salute back. Well, no, he doesn't have to salute. As a matter of fact, the salute is supposed to be something that's an honor, right? Mm-hmm. When you have an honor in the military, you know, that's something that they get to keep for themselves. The president is not in the military, and he never has been in the military. I said, this is what pissed people off. I said, I would love it if the president never saluted, because it would be a reminder that he is a civilian and that the civilians are in control of the military. Not like in some countries like Egypt, where, you know, we get all of our ideas from the generals, and the generals run crap, you know, like that is no way to run things.
Yeah, I don't even know if he was taught how to salute. He might not have ever been taught how to salute. I have no idea how civilians are working. But you're right. I mean, the Secretary of Defense, the Directors of Intelligence, these are civilian positions, they're appointed positions.
That's right.
And it's an ability to... the reason we have, you know, civilian appointees, political appointees in charge of important things like the military and defense intelligence is so you don't cloud what they call the mission creep.
Right.
Because when you're too much into the system, you kind of get tunnel vision as to what your missions are, and you lose the larger geopolitical perspective. And so they bring these civilians in who supposedly able to connect the dots between these different agencies.
So then let me bring this back to our discussion about current foreign policy. My criticism of current military policy is such that we are, like General Petraeus, for example, and Stanley McChrystal, they are sort of able to impose a more ideological form of warfare in Iraq and in Afghanistan because of, in my mind, weak presidents with weak policy or weak-willed, who just let the generals come in and basically run things. And, you know, I think that Petraeus' strategy, counterinsurgency strategy, was very good in many ways about, you know, having the troops, soldiers go out and be amongst the people in Iraq. You were one of those guys. You were out of
the Sunni Awakening.
The Sunni Awakening, right? But again, it doesn't provide for long-term stability because it didn't work. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the problem is that the civilian leadership is screwed up. And so we sort of give free rein to the military in a lot of these matters. But the military isn't supposed to be winning hearts and minds, Joe. You're supposed to break things. You know what I mean? Jar heads are supposed to
That's
go in.
That's not entirely true.
You're supposed to go in there, kick ass, and get the hell out. That's what the military is for.
Yeah, well, you know what they say in the Marine Corps, at least they let us blow shit up. But you know, you're right. There's an element of that. But, I mean, you'd be surprised. I mean, you know, in Special Operations Command, which is the tip of the spear when you're talking about counterterrorism, things like that, about, you know, 85% of the operations are non-kinetic. You know, the black pajamas and that kind of thing, the special operators that go in and they do, you know, search and rescue, search and grab, you know, snatch and grab type operations, that's about 15% of the kind of volume of warfare that they're involved in. Most of the time, they're doing hearts and minds type stuff. And there is a role for the military in doing that, but it's not the military shouldn't be the only principal in that battle. That has to be a whole of government, or dare I say, even a whole of society approach.
Mm-hmm.
Any type of battle that has to be waged on that front has to be done through many layers of government, and I think even parts of civil society. But I want to backtrack to something you said. But you mentioned Thomas Jefferson, which I'm glad you did, because you know, we get into this big discussion about foreign policy. I think we lose sight, and I think, you know, many people in your audience, many of the libertarians, have to understand that foreign policy began on this hemisphere. It began with the Western Hemisphere. And what Thomas Jefferson always said, he said, have trade and travel with all, but entangling alliances with none. He always warned us about going into Europe or in the Middle East or any of those regions and getting involved in too much in the local domestic.
Yeah, but then you remember he was kind of a hypocrite, because from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli.
Yeah, absolutely. But the point is that when we talk about foreign policy, what should be our first stopping point? Let's talk about North America. You know, is North America foreign policy? Well, yeah, it is. There's Canada, there's Mexico. But even if you broaden that horizon, when NAFTA, the main construct that defines North America today, when NAFTA was developed in 1992-93, it was developed before the fall of the Eurozone, before the rise of China, before the internet was even prevalent, mm-hmm. before a lot of the world looks as it is today. So it wasn't calculated, and it's never been revisited. And the problem is that North America alliance is weaker than it's ever been. Our partners in Canada, who are our best trade partners in the world, one of the largest trade partners in the world, One of our best allies in counterterrorism and many other issues is losing a lot of credibility with us. I mean, we're losing a lot of credibility with Canada. We don't support him on the UN Security Council. We give him a lot of problems with immigration. We won't sign the damn Keystone Pipeline. And that, you know, every time I go to Canada, I get this. And I'm like, you know, we're your friends, but that comes to a limit. You guys need to show some reciprocity. Mexico has a slew of problems that, you know, barely makes the back pages of the newspaper. If we're able to redefine North America, and I would say even expand it geographically, because, you know, where you are depends on where you look at the map. And so you have countries like Central America, which is highly dependent on the North American alliance, the third border, the Caribbean, which is how Hugo Chavez actually beat us politically in the OAS, and even Colombia. And if you redefine a greater grand strategy for North America, that's the first stopping point to fight against counterterrorism, to fight against Russia's resurgence, to fight against China's economic ambitions. That's the alliance that should be constructed, and that could create a kind of a political power project that libertarians, I think, could get behind, because it would be uphold on values that we all share.
So this will be the last question, and we'll have a discussion on it. And I think this is going to be the title of the podcast, because it's a very important question. Why are libertarians failing on foreign policy? Why are we not making any gains?
I think there's not enough libertarians that understand national security and foreign policy from a practitioner standpoint. These aren't we understand economics because you can study economics. You can learn economics through good teachers and professors, as I did at George Mason or others in other schools. But you can't study national security and foreign policy just through it. It's multidisciplinary, and it's really based off experiences and situation scenarios that have been set up over time. And I think there's not enough people, libertarians particularly, that get involved in this because they may have a bias against the state, they might have a bias against the military, and so say, I'm just going to stay away. But I think it's incumbent on people that want to really reform and really change things and make things for the better to learn the systems, learn the language, learn the opportunities, learn how the thing works, and then make suggestions on how to improve it. Because if you try to shoot rocks from the mountain, usually what happens is the mountain just sits still and just looks at you and says, you know, shoot all you want, but we're going to stay here where we are. If you kind of come in from the mountain and then you try to figure out where to mold it from, I think that has a better approach. I like to see, I do find libertarians in a lot of my meetings I do with the Department of Defense and the intel community that are in these agencies and doing their great work, but they're few and far between and they're kind of in silos. I think if you bring these guys together, you give them a platform, like your show and other places, think tanks and policy groups and others, and give them an ability to create a grand strategy of libertarian foreign policy and national security that I think the country surely needs. I think there is nobody doing that. I don't even, the neoconservative movement, I think, is a bit past its prime. I don't think people are really looking to them for solutions to some of these bigger problems. And there's a vacuum of really understanding a grand strategy for national security and foreign policy, which the libertarians could fill if they're able to unite and understand these, but do it in a manner that's credible, that understands the concepts we're talking about.
Excellent. All right. Well, Joe Heumeier, we really appreciate your time today. Thanks for your insight and expertise, and thanks for joining me on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks, Austin.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you enjoyed this podcast, do me a favor, go to iTunes and subscribe to this. You can go to iTunes, find us, The Freedom Report. And if you really enjoyed the show, do me a favor, leave us a good review. 5 stars will help us expand this show, and a written review is even better. If you don't have an Apple product, you can find us on Stitcher. That's an application you can download on your Android Stitcher app. Just go ahead and download that and subscribe to the Freedom Report podcast so you can come back every single day to your home for economic freedom and personal liberty at the Libertarian Republic.com.